He finished his tea and swung his legs to the floor. His ulcer protested at the sudden movement, and he winced with pain. Ellen said, "Again?" He nodded. "Brandy last night ought to know better." Her face was expressionless. "I suppose it has nothing to do with yesterday's half-year results." He heaved himself to his feet and walked slowly across the expanse of oyster-coloured carpet to the bathroom. The face he saw in the mirror was round and red, balding, with rolls of fat under the jaw. He examined his morning beard, pulling the loose skin this way and that to make the bristles stand up. He began to shave. He had done this every day for the last 40 years, and still he found it tiresome. Yes, the half-year results were bad. Hamilton Holdings was in trouble. When he had inherited Hamilton Printing from his father, it had been efficient, successful, and profitable. Jasper Hamilton had been a printer, fascinated by typefaces, keen on the new technology, loving the oily smell of the presses. His son was a businessman. He had taken the flow of profits from the works and diverted it into more businesses: wine importing, retailing, publishing, paper mills, commercial radio. This had achieved its primary purpose of turning income into wealth and thereby avoiding tax. Instead of Bibles and paperbacks and posters, he had concerned himself with liquidity and yields. He had bought up companies and started new enterprises, building an empire. The continuing success of the original business disguised the flimsiness of the superstructure for a long time. But when the printing complex weakened, Hamilton discovered that most of his other businesses were marginal, that he had underestimated the capital investment needed to nurse them to maturity, and that some of them were very long-term indeed. He sold 49% of his equity in each of the companies, then transferred his stock to a holding company and sold 49% of that. He raised more money and negotiated an overdraft running into 7 figures. The borrowing kept the organization alive, but the interest, rising fast through the decade, ate up what little profit there was. Meanwhile, Derek Hamilton cultivated an ulcer. The rescue program had been inaugurated almost a year ago. Credit had been tightened in an attempt to reduce the overdraft. Costs had been cut by every means possible, from cancellation of advertising campaigns to utilization of print roll-off cuts for stationery. Hamilton was running a tight ship now, but inflation and the economic slump ran faster. The 6-month results had been expected to show the world that Hamilton Holdings had turned the corner. Instead, they demonstrated further decline. He patted his face dry with a warm towel splashed on cologne and returned to the bedroom. Ellen was dressed, sitting in front of the mirror, making up her face. She always managed to dress and undress while her husband was out of the bedroom. It occurred to him that he had not seen her naked for years. He wondered why. Had she run to seed, the 55-year-old skin wrinkling and the once firm flesh sagging? Would nakedness destroy the illusion of desirability? Perhaps. But he suspected something more complex. It was obscurely connected with the way his own body had aged, he thought, as he climbed into his cavernous underpants. She was always decently clad, therefore he never lusted after her, therefore she never had to reveal how undesirable she found him. Such a combination of deviousness and sensitivity would be characteristic. She said, "What are you going to do?" The question caught him off balance. He thought at first that she must know what he was thinking and be referring to that. Then she realized she was continuing the conversation about the business. He fastened his suspenders, wondering what to tell her. "I'm not sure," he said eventually. She peered closely into the mirror, doing something to her eyelashes. "Sometimes I wonder what you want out of life." He stared at her. Her upbringing had taught her to be indirect and never to ask personal questions, for seriousness and emotion spoiled parties and caused ladies to faint. It would have cost her considerable effort to inquire about the purpose of someone's existence. He sat on the edge of his bed and spoke to her back. I must cut out brandy, that's all. I'm sure you know it has nothing to do with what you eat and drink. She applied lipstick, contorting her mouth to spread it evenly. It began 9 years ago, and your father died 10 years ago. I've got printing ink in my blood. The response came formally, like a catechism. The conversation would have seemed dislocated to an eavesdropper, but they knew its logic. There was a code. The death of his father meant his assumption of control of the business. His ulcer meant his business problems. She said, "You haven't got ink in your veins. Your father had, but you can't stand the smell of the old works. I inherited a strong business, and I want to bequeath to my sons an even stronger one. Isn't that what people of our class are supposed to do with their lives? Our sons aren't interested in what we leave them. Michael is building his own business from scratch, and all Andrew wants is to vaccinate the whole of the African continent against chickenpox." He couldn't tell how serious she was now. The thing she was doing to her face made her expression unreadable. No doubt it was deliberate. Almost everything she did was deliberate. He said, "I have a duty. I employ more than 2,000 people, and many more jobs are directly dependent upon the health of my companies." "I think you've done your duty. You kept the firm going during a time of crisis. Not everyone managed that. You've sacrificed your health to it, and you've given it 10 years of your life, and God knows what else." Her voice dropped on the final phrase, as if at the last minute she regretted saying it. "Should I give it my pride as well?" he said. He carried on dressing, tying a tight little knot in his necktie. "I've turned a jobbing printers into one of the 1,000 biggest companies in the country. My business is worth 5 times what my father was. I put it together and I have to make it work." "You have to do better than your father." "Is that such a poor ambition?" "Yes." Her sudden vehemence was a shock. "You should want good health and long life and my happiness." "If the company was prosperous, perhaps I could sell it. As things are, I wouldn't get its asset value." He looked at his watch. "I must go down." He descended the broad staircase. A portrait of his father dominated the hall. People often thought it was Derek at 50. In fact, it was Jasper at 65. The phone on the hall stand shrilled as he passed. He ignored it. He did not take calls in the morning. He went into the small dining room. The large one was reserved for parties, which were rare these days. The circular table was laid with silver cutlery. An elderly woman in an apron brought in half a grapefruit in a bone china dish. "Not today, Mrs. Tremlett," he told her. "Just a cup of tea, please." He picked up the Financial Times. The woman hesitated, then put the dish down in Ellen's place. Hamilton glanced up. "Just take it away, will you?" he said irritably. "Serve Mrs. Hamilton's breakfast when Mrs. Hamilton comes down, and not before, please." "Very good," Mrs. Tremlett murmured. She took the grapefruit away. When Ellen came in, she picked up the argument where they'd left it. "I don't think it matters whether you get 5 million or 500,000 for the company. Either way, we'd be better off than we are now. Since we don't live comfortably, I fail to see the point of being comfortably off." He put down the paper and looked at her. She was wearing an original tailored suit in a cream-coloured fabric with a printed silk blouse and handmade shoes. He said, "You have a pleasant home with a small staff. You've friends here and a social life in town when you care to take advantage of it. This morning you're wearing several hundred pounds worth of clothes, and you'll probably go no farther than the village. Sometimes I wonder what you want out of life." She blushed. A rare event. "I'll tell you," she began. There was a knock at the door, and a good-looking man came in, wearing an overcoat and carrying a cap. "Oh, good morning, madam," he said. "If we're to catch the 7:45, sir..." Hamilton said, "All right, Pritchard, just wait in the hall." "Very good, sir. May I ask if you'll be using the car today, madam?" Hamilton looked at Ellen. She kept her eyes on her dish as she said, "I expect so, yes." Pritchard nodded and went out. Hamilton said, "You were about to tell me what you want out of life." "I don't think it's a breakfast table subject, especially when you're rushing to catch a train." Very well. He stood up. Enjoy your drive. Don't go too fast. What? Drive carefully. Oh, Pritchard drives me. He bent to kiss her cheek. But she turned her face to him and kissed his lips. When he pulled away, her face was flushed. She held his arm and said, I want you, Derek. He stared at her. I want us to spend a long, contented retirement together, she went on, speaking hurriedly. I want you to relax and eat the right food and grow healthy and slim again. I want the man who came courting in an open-topped Riley, and the man who came back from the war with medals and married me, and the man who held my hand when I bore my children. I want to love you. He stood nonplussed. She had never been like this with him, never. He felt hopelessly incapable of dealing with it. He didn't know what to say, what to do, where to look. He said, I must catch the train. She regained her composure quickly. Yes. You must hurry. He looked at her a moment longer, but she would not meet his eyes. He said, Goodbye. She nodded dumbly. He went out. He put on his hat in the hall, then let Pritchard open the front door for him. The dark blue Mercedes stood on the gravel drive, gleaming in the sunshine. Pritchard must wash it every morning before I get up, Hamilton thought. The conversation with Ellen had been most peculiar, he decided, as they drove to the railway station. Through the window he watched the play of sunlight on the already browning leaves and ran over the key scenes in his mind. I want to love you, she'd said, with the emphasis on you. Talking of the things he'd sacrificed for the business, she had said, and God knows what else. I want to love you, not someone else. Was that what she meant? Had he lost the fidelity of his wife as well as his health? Perhaps she simply wanted him to think she might be having an affair. That was more like Ellen. She dealt in subtleties. Cries for help were not her style. After the 6 month results, he needed domestic problems like a creditor's meeting. There was something else. She blushed when Pritchard asked if she would be using the car. Then hastily she had said, Pritchard drives me. Hamilton said, Where do you take Mrs. Hamilton, Pritchard? She drives herself, sir. I make myself useful around the house. There's always been... Yes, all right, Hamilton interrupted. This isn't a time and motion study. I was only curious. Sir? His ulcers stabbed him. Tea, he thought. I should drink milk in the morning. Chapter 6 Herbert Cheeseman switched on the light, silenced the alarm clock, turned up the volume of the radio which had been playing all night, and pressed the rewind button of the reel-to-reel tape recorder. Then he got out of bed. He put the kettle on and stared out of the studio apartment window while he waited for the 7 hour tape to return to the start. The morning was clear and bright. The sun would be strong later, but now it was chilly. He put on trousers and a sweater over the underwear he had worn in bed and stepped into carpet slippers. His home was a large single room in a North London Victorian house which was past its best. The furniture, the Ascot heater, and the old gas cooker belonged to the landlord. The radio was Herbert's. His rent included the use of a communal bathroom and, most important, exclusive use of the attic. The radio dominated the room. It was a powerful VHF receiver, made from parts he had carefully selected in half a dozen shops along Tottenham Court Road. The aerial was in the roof loft. The tape deck was also homemade. He poured tea into a cup, added condensed milk from a tin, and sat at his work table. Apart from the electronic equipment, the table bore only a telephone, a ruled exercise book, and a ballpoint pen. He opened the book at a clean page and wrote the date at the top in a large cursive script. Then he reduced the volume of the radio and began to play the night's tape at high speed. Each time a high-pitched squeal indicated that there was speech on the recording, he slowed the reel with his finger until he could distinguish the words. Car proceed to Holloway Road, the bottom end to assist PC. Ludlow Road, West 5, and Mrs. Shaftesbury. Sounds like a domestic. 21. Inspector says if that Chinese is still open, you'll have chicken fried rice with chips. Holloway Road, get a move on. That PC's in trouble. Herbert stopped the tape and made a note. Reported burglary of a house. That's near Wimbledon Common, Jack. 18, do you read? Any cars, Lee area, free to assist fire brigade at 22 Feather Street. Herbert made another note. 18, do you read? I don't know. Give her an aspirin. Assault with a knife, not serious. Where the hell have you been, 18? Herbert's attention strayed to the photograph on the mantelpiece above the boarded-in fireplace. The picture was flattering. Herbert had known this 20 years ago, when she'd given it to him. But now he'd forgotten. Oddly, he didn't think of her as she really had been any more. When he remembered her, he visualised a woman with flawless skin and hand-tinted cheeks, posing before a faded panorama in a photographer's studio. Theft of one colour television and damage to a plate-glass window. He had been the first among his circle of friends to lose the wife, as they'd put it. Two or three of them had suffered the tragedy since. One had become a cheerful drunkard, another had married a widow. Herbert had buried his head in his hobby, radio. He began listening to police broadcasts during the day when he did not feel well enough to go to work, which was quite often. Grey Avenue, Golders Green reported assault. One day, after hearing the police talk about a bank raid, he'd telephoned the Evening Post. A reporter had thanked him for the information and taken his name and address. The raid had been a big one, £250,000, and the story was on the front page of the Post that evening. Herbert had been proud to have given them the tip-off and told the story in 3 pubs that night. Then he forgot about it. 3 months later, he got a cheque for £50 from the newspaper. With the cheque was a statement which read, 2 shot in £250,000 raid, and gave the date of the robbery. Leave it out, Charlie. If she won't make a complaint, forget it. The following day, Herbert had stayed at home and phoned the Post every time he picked something up on the police wavelength. That afternoon, he got a call from a man who said he was deputy news editor, to explain just what the paper wanted from people like Herbert. He was told not to report an assault unless a gun was used or someone was killed, not to bother with burglaries unless the address was in Belgravia, Chelsea or Kensington, not to report robberies except when weapons were used or very large amounts of cash stolen. Proceed to 23 Narrow Road and wait. He got the idea quickly because he was not stupid and the Post's news values were far from subtle. Soon he realised he was earning slightly more on his sick days than when he went to work. What was more, he preferred listening to the radio to making boxes for cameras. So he gave in his notice and became what the newspaper called an earwig. Better give me that description now. After he'd been working full-time on the radio for a few weeks, the deputy news editor came to his house. It was before he moved to the studio apartment to talk to him. The newspaper man said Herbert's work was very useful to the paper, and how would he like to work for them exclusively? That would mean Herbert would phone tips only to the Post and not to other papers, but he would get a weekly retainer to make up for the loss of income. Herbert did not say that he had never phoned any other papers. He accepted the offer graciously. Sit tight and we'll get some assistance in a few minutes. Over the years, he'd improved both his equipment and his understanding of what the newspaper wanted. He learned that they were grateful for more or less anything early in the morning, but as the day wore on, they became more choosy, until by about 3 p.m. nothing less than murder in the street or large-scale robbery with violence interested them. He also discovered that the paper, like the police, was a lot less interested in a crime done to a coloured man in a coloured area. Herbert thought this quite reasonable, since he, as an Evening Post reader, was not much interested in what the Woggs did to each other in their own parts of London, and he surmised correctly that the reason the Post was not interested was simply that people like Herbert who bought the Post weren't interested. And he learned to read between the lines of police jargon, knew when an assault was trivial or a complaint domestic, heard the note of urgency in the operations room sergeant's voice when a call for assistance was desperate, discovered how to switch his mind off when they decided to read out great lists of stolen car numbers over the air. The speeded-up sound of his own alarm clock came out of the big speaker and he turned the deck off. He increased the volume on the radio, then dialed Post's number. He sipped his tea while he waited for an answer.
Post, good morning.
It was a man's voice.
Copy takers, please, Herbert said.
There was another pause.
Copy.
Hello, Cheeseman here, timing at 0759. There was a clatter of typewriters in the background. Hello, Bertie, how are you doing?
Seems to have been a quiet night, Herbert said.
This ends side two of cassette one. Please stop the tape before fast-forwarding to the end and loading cassette two. Paper Money, cassette two.
8 a.m. Chapter 7. Tony Cox stood in a phone booth on the corner of Quill Street, Bethnal Green, with the receiver to his ear. He was perspiring inside the warm coat with a velvet collar. In his hand he held the end of a chain which was attached to the collar of the dog outside. The dog was sweating, too. The phone at the other end of the line was answered, and Tony pressed a coin into the slot. A voice said, "Yes." In the tone of one who is not really accustomed to these new-fangled telephones, Tony spoke curtly. "It's today. Get it together." He hung up without giving his name or waiting for an answer. He strode off along the narrow pavement, pulling the dog behind him. It was a pedigree boxer with a trim, powerful body, and Tony continually had to yank at the chain to make it keep pace. The dog was strong, but its master was a great deal stronger. The doors of the old terraced houses gave directly onto the street. Tony stopped at the one outside which was parked the grey Rolls-Royce. He pushed the house door open. It was never locked, for the occupants had no fear of thieves. There was a smell of cooking in the little house. Pulling the dog behind him, Tony went into the kitchen and sat on a chair. He unhooked the chain from the dog's collar and sent it away with a hefty slap on the rump. He stood up and took off his coat. A kettle was warming on the gas cooker, and there was sliced bacon on a piece of greaseproof paper. Tony opened a drawer and took out a kitchen knife with a 10-inch blade. He tested the edge with his thumb, decided it needed sharpening, and went out into the yard. There was an old grinding wheel in the lean-to shed. Tony sat beside it on a wooden stool and worked the treadle, the way he'd seen the old man do it years ago. It made Tony feel good to do things the way his father had. He pictured him, a tall man and handsome, with wavy hair and glittering eyes, making sparks with the grinder while his children shrieked with laughter. He'd been a stallholder in a street market, selling china and saucepans, calling his wares in that strong, carrying voice. He used to make a performance of pretending to needle the grocer next to him, shouting, "There you are! I just sold a pot for half a nickel. How many spuds do you sell before you take 10 bob? He could spot a strange woman yards away, and would use his good looks shamelessly. "I tell you what, darling," this to a middle-aged woman in a hairnet, "we don't get so many beautiful young girls down the centre of the market, so I'm going to sell you this at a loss and hope you'll come back. Look at it. Solid copper bottom, if you'll pardon the word, and it's my last one. I made my profit on the rest so you can have it for £2, half what I paid for it, just because you made an old man's heart beat faster, and take it quick before I change me mind." Tony had been shocked by the speed at which the old man changed after the one lung went. His hair turned white, the cheeks sank between the bones, and the fine voice went high and whining. The store was rightfully Tony's, but by then he had his own sources of income, so he'd let it go to young Harry, his dumb brother, who'd married a beautiful Whitechapel girl with the patience to learn how to talk with her hands. It took guts for a dumb man to run a market store, writing on a blackboard when he needed to speak to the customers, and keeping in his pocket a plain postcard bearing the word "Thanks" in capital letters to flash when a sale was made. But he ran it well, and Tony lent him the money to move into a proper shop and hire a manager, and he'd made a success of that too. Guts. They ran in the family. The kitchen knife was sharp enough. He tested it and cut his thumb. Holding it to his lips, he went into the kitchen. His mother was there. Lillian Cox was short and a little overweight. Her son had inherited the tendency to plumpness without the shortness, and she had much more energy than the average 63-year-old. She said, "I'm doing you a bit of fried bread." "Lovely." He put the knife down and found a bandage. "Take care with that knife, for I done it a bit too sharp." She fussed over his cut, then, making him hold it under the cold tap and count to 100, then putting on antiseptic cream and gauze, and finally a roll of bandage held with a safety pin. He stood still and let her do what she wished. She said, "Oh, but you're a good boy to sharpen the knives for me. Where you been so early, anyhow?" "Took the dog up to park. And I had to ring someone up." She made a disgusted noise. "I don't know what's wrong with a phone in the parlour, I'm sure." He leaned over the cooker to sniff the frying bacon. "You know how it is, Mum. The old Bill listened to that one." She put a teapot in his hand. "Go in here and pour the tea, then." He took the pot into the living room and put it down on a mat. The square table was laid with an embroidered cloth, cutlery for two, salt and pepper and sauce bottles. Tony sat nearest the fireplace, where the old man used to sit. From there, he reached into the sideboard and took out two cups and two saucers. He pictured the old man again, overseeing mealtimes with the back of his hand and a good deal of rhyming slang. "Get your chalks off the cane," he'd bark if they put their arms on the table. The only thing Tony held against him was the way he treated Mum. Being so handsome and that, he had a few women on the side, and at times he'd spend his money buying them gin instead of bringing it home. Those times, Tony and his brother would go up the Smithfield Market, stealing scraps from under the tables to sell to the soap factory for a few coppers. And he never went in the army, but then a lot of wide boys went on the trot in wartime. "What are you going to do? Go back to sleep or pour that tea out?" Lillian put a plate in front of Tony and sat down opposite him. "Never mind, I'll do it now." Tony picked up his cutlery, holding his knife like a pencil, and began to eat. There were sausages, two fried eggs, a mess of canned tomatoes, and several slices of fried bread. He took a mouthful before reaching for the brown sauce. He was hungry after his morning's exertions. His mother passed him his tea. She said, "Oh, you know, we was never afraid to use the phone when your father was alive, God rest his soul. He was careful to stay out of the way of the old Bill." Tony thought they'd had no phone in his father's day, but he let that pass. He said, "Yeah, he was so careful he died a pauper."
"But an honest one."
"Was he?"
"You know bloody well he was, and never let me hear you say no different."
"I don't like to hear you swear, Mum."
"You shouldn't provoke me."
Tony ate silently and finished quickly. He emptied his teacup and began to unwrap a cigar. His mother picked up his cup. "More tea?" He looked at his watch. "No, thanks. I've got a couple of things to do." He set fire to the cigar and stood up. "That set me up lovely, that breakfast." She narrowed her eyes. "Are you having a tickle?" This annoyed him. He blew smoke into the air. "Who needs to know?" "It's your life. Go on, and I'll see you later. Mind you look after yourself." He looked at her a moment longer. Although she gave in to him, she was a strong woman. She'd led the family since the old man went, mending marriages, borrowing from one son to lend to another, giving advice, using her disapproval as a powerful sanction. She'd resisted all efforts to move her from Quill Street to a nice little bungalow in Bournemouth, suspecting, rightly, that the old house and its memories were a potent symbol of her authority. Once there had been queenly arrogance in her high-bridged nose and pointed chin. Now she was regal but resigned, like an abdicated monarch, knowing she was wise to release the reins of power, but regretting it all the same. Tony realized that this was why she needed him. He was king now, and having him to live with her kept her close to the throne. He loved her for needing him. No one else needed him. She stood up. "Well, are you going?" "Yes." He realized he'd been lost in thought. He put an arm around her shoulders and squeezed briefly. He never kissed her. "Ciao, Mum." He picked up his coat, patted the dog, and went out. The interior of the Rolls was hot. He pressed the button that lowered the window before settling himself in the leather seat and pulling away. He took pleasure in the car as he threaded it through the narrow East End streets, its shameless luxury in contrast with the mean streets and undignified old houses, told the story of Tony Cox's life. People looked at the car, housewives, paperboys, working men, villains, and said to each other, "There's Tony Cox, he did well." He flicked cigar ash through the open window. He had done well. He'd bought his first car for £6 when he was 16 years old. The blank Ministry of Transport certificate had cost him 30 shillings on the black market. He filled in the blanks and resold the car for £80. Before long, he had a used car lot, which he gradually turned into a legitimate business. Then he sold it, with the stock, for £5,000 and went into the long firm racket. He used the £5,000 to open a bank account, giving as a reference the name of the man who had bought the car lot. He told the bank manager his real name, but gave a false address, the same false address he'd given the purchaser of the car business. He took a lease on a warehouse, paying 3 months' rent in advance. He bought small quantities of radio, television and hi-fi equipment from manufacturers and resold it to shops in London. He paid suppliers on the dot and his bank account was busy. Within a couple of months, he was making a small loss and had a reputation for creditworthiness. At that point, he made a series of very large orders. Small manufacturers, to whom he had promptly paid a couple of bills of £500 each, were glad to supply him with £3,000 or £4,000 worth of goods on the same credit terms. He looked like becoming a good customer. With a warehouse full of expensive electronic gadgetry for which he'd paid nothing, he held a sale. Record players, colour television sets, digital clocks, tape decks, amplifiers and radios went for knockdown prices, sometimes as little as half their retail value. In 2 days, the warehouse was empty and Tony Cox had £3,000 in cash in 2 suitcases. He locked the warehouse and went home. He shivered in the front seat of the warm car as he remembered he would never take risks like those again. Suppose one of the suppliers had got wind of the sale. Suppose the bank manager had seen Tony in a pub a few days later. He still did the occasional long firm, but these days he used front men who took long holidays in Spain as soon as the axe fell, and nobody saw Tony's face. However, his business interests had diversified. He owned property in central London, which he let to young ladies at extremely high rents. He ran nightclubs. He even managed a couple of pop groups. Some of his projects were legitimate, some criminal, some were a mixture, and others were on the nebulous borderline between the two, where the law is unsure of itself, but respectable businessmen with reputations to worry about fear to tread. The old Bill knew about him, of course. There were so many grasses about nowadays that nobody could become a respected villain without his name going into a file at Scotland Yard. But getting evidence was the problem, especially with a few detectives around who were prepared to warn Tony in advance of a raid. The money he spent in that direction was never skimped. Every August, there were 3 or 4 police families in Benidorm on Tony's money. Not that he trusted them. They were useful, but they were all telling themselves that one day they would repay their debt of loyalty by turning him in. A bent copper was still ultimately a copper. So all transactions were cash. No books were kept, except in Tony's head. All jobs were done by his cronies on verbal instructions. Increasingly, he played even safer by simply acting as a banker. A draftsman would get some inside information and dream up a plan. Then he would recruit a villain to organise the equipment and manpower. The two of them would then come to Tony and tell him the plan. If he liked it, he would lend them the money for bribes, guns, motorcars, explosives, and anything else they needed. When they'd done the job, they would repay the loan 5 or 6 times over out of the proceeds. Today's job was not so simple. He was draftsman as well as banker for this one. It meant he had to be extra careful. He stopped the car in a back street and got out. Here the houses were larger. They'd been built for foremen and craftsmen rather than dockers and labourers, but they were no more sound than the hovels of Quill Street. The concrete facings were cracking, the wooden window frames were rotten, and the front gardens were smaller than the trunk of Tony's car. Only about half of them were lived in, the rest were warehouses, offices or shops. The door Tony knocked on bore the sign Billiards and Snooker, with most of the "and" missing. It was opened immediately, and he stepped inside. He shook hands with Walter Burden, then followed him upstairs. A road accident had left Walter with a limp and a stammer, depriving him of his job as a docker. Tony had given him the managership of the billiards hall, knowing that the gesture, which cost Tony nothing,
would be rewarded by increased respect among EastEnders and undying loyalty on Walter's part. Walter said, "Want a cup of tea, Tony?"
"No, thanks, Walter. I just had my breakfast."
He looked around the first floor hall with a proprietorial air. The tables were covered, the linoleum floor swept, the cues racked neatly.
"You keep the place nice." "Only doing my job, Tone. You looked after me, see?"
"Yeah." Cox went to the window and looked down on the street. A blue Morris 1100 was parked a few yards away on the opposite side of the road. There were two people in it. Tony felt curiously satisfied. He'd been right to take this precaution.
"Where's your phone, Walter?"
"In the office."
Walter opened a door, ushered Tony in, and closed it, staying outside. The office was tidy and clean. Tony sat at the desk and dialed a number. A voice said,
"Yeah?"
"Pick me up,"
Tony said.
5 minutes.
Tony hung up. His cigar had gone out. When things made him nervous, he let his smoke go out. He relit it with a gold Dunhill, then went out. He showed himself at the window again.
"All right, mate, I'm off," he said to Walter. "If one of the young detective constables in a blue car takes it into his head to knock on the door, don't answer it. I'll be about half an hour."
"Don't worry. You can rely on me, you know that."
Walter nodded his head like a bird.
"Your Honour."
Tony touched the old man's shoulder briefly, then went to the back of the hall. He opened the door and trotted rapidly down the fire escape. He picked his way around a rusting baby carriage, a sodden mattress, and three-fifths of an old car. Weeds sprouted stubbornly in the cracked concrete of the yard. A grubby cat scampered out of his way. His Italian shoes got dirty. A gate led from the yard to a narrow lane. Tony walked to the end of the lane. As he got there, a small red Fiat with three men in it drew up at the curb. Tony got in and sat in the empty seat in the back. The car pulled away immediately. The driver was Jacko, Tony's first lieutenant. Beside Jacko was Deaf Willie, who knew more about explosives now than he had 20 years ago when he lost his left eardrum. In the back with Tony was Peter Jesse James, whose two obsessions were firearms and girls with fat bottoms. They were good men, all permanent members of Tony's firm.
Tony said, "How's the boy, Willie?"
Deaf Willie turned his good ear toward Tony.
"What?"
"I said, how's young Billy?"
18 today, Willie said. "He's the same, Tone. He'll never be able to look after himself. The social worker told us to think about putting him in a home."
Tony tutted sympathetically. He went out of his way to be kind to Deaf Willie's half-witted son. Mental illness frightened him.
"You don't want to do that,"
Willie said. "I said to the wife, what does a social worker know? This one's a girl of about 20, been to college. Still, she don't push herself."
Jocko broke in impatiently.
"We're all set, Tony. The lads are there. The motors are ready."
"Good."
Tony looked at Jesse James.
"Shooters?" "Got a couple of shotguns and an Uzi."
"Oh, what?"
Jesse grinned proudly. "It's a 9mm machine pistol.
Israeli."
"Stroll on,"
Tony muttered.
Jacko said, "Here we are."
Tony took a cloth cap from his pocket and fixed it on his head. "You put the lads indoors, have you?"
"Yes," Jacko said.
"I don't mind them knowing it's a Tony Cox job, but I don't want them to be able to say they saw me."
"I know."
The car pulled into a scrapyard. It was a remarkably tidy yard. The shelves of cars were piled three high in orderly lines, and component parts were stacked neatly round about. Pillars of tyres, a pyramid of rear axles, a cube of cylinder blocks. Near the gateway were a crane and a long car transporter. Farther in, a plain blue Ford van with double rear wheels stood next to the yard's heavy-duty oxyacetylene cutting gear. The car stopped and Tony got out. He was pleased. He liked things neat. The other three stood around, waiting for him to do something. Jacko lit a cigarette. Tony said,
"Did you fix the owner of the yard?"
Jacko nodded. "He made sure the crane, the transporter and the cutting gear were here, but he doesn't know what they're for,
and we've tied him up just for the sake of appearances. He started to cough.
Tony took the cigarette out of Jacko's mouth and dropped it in the mud.
"Those things make you cough," he said. He took a cigar from his pocket. "Smoke this and die old."
Tony walked back toward the yard gate. The three men followed. Tony trod gingerly around potholes and swampy patches, past a stack of thousands of lead-acid accumulators between mounds of driveshafts and gearboxes, to the crane. It was a smallish model on caterpillar tracks, capable of lifting a car, a van, or a light truck. He unbuttoned his overcoat and climbed the ladder to the high cab. He sat in the operator's seat. The all-round windows enabled him to see the whole of the yard. It was triangular in plan. One side was a railway viaduct, its brick arches filled in by storerooms. A high wall on the adjacent side separated the yard from a playground and a bomb site. The road ran along the front of the yard, curving slightly as it followed the bend of the river a few yards beyond. It was a wide road, but little used. In the lee of the viaduct was a hut made of old wooden doors supporting a tar-paper roof. The men would be in there, huddled around an electric fire, drinking tea and smoking nervously. Everything was right. Tony felt elation rise in his belly, as instinct told him it would work. He climbed out of the crane. He deliberately kept his voice low, steady and casual.
"This van doesn't always go the same route. There are lots of ways from the city to Loughton. But this place is on most of the routes, right? They've got to pass here unless they want to go via Birmingham or Watford. Now, they do go daft ways occasionally. Today might be one of those days. So if it doesn't come off, just give the lads a bonus and send them home until next time."
Jacko said, "They all know the score."
"Good. Anything else?"
The three men were silent. Tony gave his final instructions.
"Everybody wears a mask. Everybody wears gloves. Nobody speaks."
He looked to each man in turn for acknowledgement. Then he said,
"Okay, take me back."
There was no conversation as the red Fiat wound its way through the little streets to the lane behind the billiard hall. Tony got out, then leaned on the front passenger door and spoke through the open window.
"It's a good plan, and if you do right, it'll work. There's a couple of wrinkles you don't know about. Safeguards, inside men. Keep calm, do good, and we'll have it away."
He paused.
"And don't shoot nobody with that bleeding Tommy gun, for fuck's sake."
He walked up the lane and entered the billiard hall by the back door. Walter was playing billiards at one of the tables. He straightened up when he heard the door.
"All right, Tone."
Tony went to the window.
"Did your pally stay put?"
He could see the blue Morris in the same place.
"Yeah. They've been smoking herself to death."
It was fortunate, Tony thought, that the law didn't have enough manpower to watch him at night as well as in the day. The 9-to-5 surveillance was quite useful, for it permitted him to establish alibis without seriously restricting his activities. One of these days they'd start following him 24 hours a day, but he'd have plenty of advance notice of that. Walter jerked a thumb at the table.
"Fancy a break?"
"Nah." Tony left the window. "I've got a busy day." He went down the stairs and Walter hobbled after him.
"Cha-cha, Walter," he said as he went out into the street. "So long, Tony." Walter said, "God bless you, boy."
Chapter 8. The newsroom came to life suddenly. At 8 o'clock it had been still as a morgue, the quietness broken only by inanimate sounds like the stuttering of the teleprinter and the rustle of the newspapers Cole was reading. Now, three copy-takers were pounding the keys, a lad was whistling a pop song, and a photographer in a leather coat was arguing with a sub-editor about a football match. The reporters were drifting in. Most of them had an early morning routine, Cole had observed. One bought tea, another lit a cigarette, another turned to page 3 of the Sun to look at the nude, each using an habitual crutch to help him start the day. Cole believed in letting people sit down for a few minutes before setting them to work. It made for an atmosphere of order and cool-headedness. His news editor, Cliff Polson, had a different approach. Polson, with his frog-like green eyes and Yorkshire accent, liked to say, "Don't take your coat off, lad." His delight in snap decisions, his perpetual hurry, and his brittle air of bonhomie created a frenetic atmosphere. Paulson was a speed freak. Cole didn't reckon a story had ever missed an edition because someone took a minute out to think about it. Kevin Hart had been here for 5 minutes now. He was reading the Mirror, with one hip perched on the edge of a desk, the trousers of his striped suit falling gracefully. Cole called out to him, "Give the yard a ring, please, Kevin." The young man picked up a telephone. The Bertie Cheeseman tips were on his desk, a thick wad of copy. Cole looked around. Most of the reporters were in. It was time to get them working. He sorted through the tips, impaling some on a sharp metal spike, handing others to reporters with brief instructions. "Anna, a PC got into trouble in the Holloway Road. Ring the nearest Nick and find out what it was all about. If it's drunks, forget it. Joe, this fire in the East End. Check with the brigade. A burglary in Chelsea, Philip. Look up the address in Kelly's directory in case anyone famous lives there. Barney, police pursued and arrested an Irishman after calling at a house in Queenstown Road, Camden. Ring the yard and ask them if there's anything to do with the IRA. An internal phone beeped and he lifted it. "Arthur Cole.
What have you got for me, Arthur?"
Cole recognised the voice of the picture editor. He said, "At the moment it looked as though the splash would be last night's vote in the Commons. But that was on television yesterday. Do you call to ask me things or tell me things? I suppose I'd better have somebody at Downing Street for a Today picture of the Prime Minister. Anything else?"
"Nothing that isn't in the morning papers."
"Thank you, Arthur." Cole hung up. It was poor to be leading on a yesterday story. He was doing his best to update it. Two reporters were ringing around for reactions. They were getting backbench MPs to shoot off their mouths, but no ministers. A middle-aged reporter with a pipe called out, "Mrs. Paulson just rang. Cliff won't be in today. He's got deli belly." Cole groaned. How did he catch that in Orpington? Curry supper.
Okay. That was clever, Cole thought. It looked like being the dullest day for news in the month, and Paulson was off sick. With the assistant news editor on holiday, Cole was on his own.
Kevin Hart approached the desk. "Nothing in the yard," he said. "It's been quiet all night." Cole looked up. Hart was about 23 and very tall, with curly fair hair which he wore long. Cole suppressed the spasm of irritation. "That's ridiculous," he said. "Scotland Yard never has a completely quiet night. What's the matter with that press bureau?" "We ought to do a story. London's first crime-free night for 1,000 years, Hart said with a grin. His levity annoyed Cole. "Never be satisfied with that kind of reply from the Yard," he said coldly. Hart flushed. It embarrassed him to be lectured like a cub reporter. "I'll ring them back, shall I?" "No," said Cole, seeing that he'd made his point. "I want you to do a story. You know this new oil field in the North Sea?" Hart nodded. "It's called Shield." "Yes. Later on, the energy minister is going to announce who's got the license to develop it. Do a holding piece to run until we get the announcement. Background, what the license will mean to the people who are bidding, how the minister makes up his mind. This afternoon, we can sling your piece out and leave a hole in the paper for the real news." "Okay." Hart turned away and made for the library. He knew he was being given a dumb job as a kind of punishment, but he took his medicine gracefully, Cole thought. He stared at the boy's back for a moment. He got on Cole's nerves with his long hair and his suits. He had rather too much self-confidence, but then reporters needed a lot of cheek. Cole stood up and went to the sub-editor's table. The deputy chief sub had in front of him the wire service story about the passing of the industry bill and the new stuff Cole's reporters had come up with. Cole looked over his shoulder. On a scratch pad he'd written, "Rebel MPs told join the Libs." The man scratched his beard and looked up. "What do you think?" "Looks like a story about women's lib," Cole said. "I hate it."
"So do I."
The sub tore the sheet off the pad, crumpled it and tossed it in a metal bin. "What else is new?" "Nothing. I've only just given out the tips."
The bearded man nodded and glanced reflexively at the clock hanging from the ceiling in front. "Let's hope we get something decent for the second."
Cole leaned over him and wrote on the pad, "Rebel MPs told join Liberals." He said, "It makes more sense, but it's the same count." The sub grinned. "Want a job?"
Cole went back to his desk. Annala Sims came up and said, "The Holy Road incident came to nothing. A bunch of rowdies, no arrests." Cole said, "Okay." Joe Barnard put down the phone and called. "There's not a lot to this fire, Arthur. Nobody hurt." "How many people living there?" Cole said automatically. "Two adults, three children." "So? It's a family of five escaped death. Write it." Philip Jones said, "The burgled flat seems to belong to Nicholas Cross, quite a well-known violinist." "Good," Cole said. "Ring Chelsea, Nick, and find out what was taken." "I did already," Philip grinned. "There's a Stradivarius missing." Cole smiled. "Good boy. Write it, then. Get down there and see if you can interview the heartbroken maestro." The phone rang, and Cole picked it up. Although he wouldn't have admitted it, he was thoroughly enjoying himself. 9 a.m. Chapter 9. Tim Fitzpeterson was dry of tears, but the weeping had not helped. He lay on the bed, his face buried in the damp pillow. To move was agony. He tried not to think at all, his mind turning away thoughts like an innkeeper with a full house. At one point his brain switched off completely and he dozed for a few moments. But the escape from pain and despair was brief, and he woke up again. He did not rise from the bed because there was nothing he wanted to do, nowhere he could go, nobody he felt he could face. All he could do was think about the promise of joy that had been so false. Cox had been right when he said so coarsely, "It was the best night's nookie you'll ever have." Tim could not quite banish the flashing memories of her slim, writhing body. But now they had a dreadfully bitter taste. She had shown him paradise, then slammed the door. She, of course, had been faking ecstasy, but there had been nothing simulated about Tim's own pleasure. A few hours ago he had been contemplating a new life, enhanced by the kind of sexual love he had forgotten existed. Now it was hard to see any point at all in tomorrow. He could hear the noise of the children in the playground outside, shouting and shrieking and quarrelling, and he envied them the utter triviality of their lives. He pictured himself as a schoolboy, in a black blazer and short grey trousers, walking 3 miles of Dorset country lanes to get to the one-class primary school. He was the brightest pupil they'd ever had, which was not saying much. But they taught him arithmetic and got him a place at the grammar school, and that was all he needed. He flourished in the grammar school, he remembered. He'd been the leader of the gang, the one who organised playground games and classroom rebellions. Until he got his glasses. There. He'd been trying to remember when in his life he had felt despair like this, and now he knew. It had been the first day he wore his glasses to school. The members of his gang had been at first dismayed, then amused, then scornful. By playtime he was being followed by a crowd chanting, "Four eyes!" After lunch he tried to organise a football match, but John Wilcott said, "It's not your game." Tim put his spectacles in their case and punched Wilcott's head. But Wilcott was big, and Tim, who normally dominated by force of personality, was no fighter. Tim ended up staunching a bloody nose in the cloakroom while Wilcott picked teams. He tried to make a comeback during history by flicking inky paper pellets at Wilcott under the nose of Miss Percival, known as Old Percy, but the normally indulgent Percy decided to have a clamp down that day, and Tim was sent to the headmaster for 6 of the best. On the way home he had another fight, lost again, and tore his blazer. His mother took the money for a new one out of the nest egg Tim was saving to buy a crystal radio set, setting him back 6 months. It was the blackest day of young Tim's life, and his leadership qualities remained stifled until he went to college and joined the party. A lost fight, a torn blazer, and 6 of the best. He could wish for problems like that now. A whistle blew in the playground outside the flat, and the noise of the children ceased abruptly. "I could end my troubles that quickly," Tim thought. And the idea appealed. "What was I living for yesterday?" he wondered. "Good work, my reputation, a successful government. None of these things seemed to matter today." The school whistle meant it was past 9 o'clock. Tim